The fast-moving events of those days not only prevented her plans from being carried out, they made her regret having conceived them. The war, which until then had been only a word to designate a vague and remote circumstance, became a concrete and dramatic reality. Around the end of February, an old woman with an ashen look arrived in Macondo riding a donkey loaded down with brooms. She seemed so inoffensive that the sentries let her pass without any question as another vendor, one of the many who often arrived from the towns in the swamp. She went directly to the barracks. Arcadio received her in the place where the classroom used to be, and which at that time had been transformed into a kind of rearguard encampment, with rolled hammocks hanging on hooks and mats piled up in the corners, and rifles and carbines and even hunting shotguns scattered on the floor. The old woman stiffened into a military salute before identifying herself. "I am Colonel Gregorio Stevenson." He brought bad news. The last centers of liberal resistance, according to what he said, were being wiped out. Colonel Aureliano Buendia, whom he had left fighting in retreat near Riohacha, had given him a message for Arcadio. He should surrender the town without resistance, on the condition that the lives and property of liberals would be respected. Arcadio examined that strange messenger, who could have been a fugitive grandmother, with a look of pity. "You have brought something in writing, naturally," he said. "Naturally," the emissary answered, "I have brought nothing of the sort. It's easy to understand that under the present circumstances a person can't carry anything that would compromise him." As he was speaking, he reached into his bodice and took out a small gold fish. "I think that this will be sufficient," he said. Arcadio could see that indeed it was one of the little fishes made by Colonel Aureliano Buendia. But anyone could have bought it before the war or stolen it, and it had no merit as a safe conduct pass. The messenger even went to the extreme of violating a military secret so that they would believe his identity. He revealed that he was on a mission to Curaçao, where he hoped to recruit exiles from all over the Caribbean and acquire arms and supplies sufficient to attempt a landing at the end of the year. With faith in that plan, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was not in favor of any useless sacrifices at that time, but Arcadio was inflexible. He had the prisoner put into the stocks until he could prove his identity, and he resolved to defend the town to the death. He did not have long to wait. The news of the liberal defeat was more and more concrete. Toward the end of March, before a dawn of premature rain, the tense calm of the previous weeks was abruptly broken by the desperate sounds of a cornet and a cannon shot that knocked down the steeple of the church. Actually, Arcadio's decision to resist was madness. He had only 50 poorly armed men with a ration of 20 cartridges apiece. But among them, his former pupils, excited by the high-sounding proclamations, the determination reigned to sacrifice their skins for a lost cause. In the midst of the tramping of boots, contradictory commands, cannon shots that made the earth tremble, wild shooting, and the senseless sound of cornets, the supposed Colonel Stevenson managed to speak to Arcadio. "Don't let me undergo the indignity of dying in the stocks in these women's clothes," he said to him. "If I have to die, let me die fighting." He succeeded in convincing him. Arcadio ordered them to give him a weapon and 20 cartridges, and he left him with 5 men to defend headquarters while he went off with his staff to head up the resistance. He did not get to the road to the swamp. The barricades had been broken, and the defenders were openly fighting in the streets, first until they used up their ration of rifle bullets, then with pistols against rifles, and finally hand to hand. With the imminence of defeat, some women went into the street armed with sticks and kitchen knives. In that confusion, Arcadio found Amaranta, who was looking for him like a madwoman, in her nightgown, and with 2 old pistols that had belonged to José Arcadio Buendía. He gave his rifle to an officer who had been disarmed in the fight, and escaped with Amaranta through a nearby street to take her home. Ursula was in the doorway waiting, indifferent to the cannon shots that had opened up a hole in the front of the house next door. The rain was letting up, but the streets were as slippery and as smooth as melted soap, and one had to guess distances in the darkness. Arcadio left Amaranta with Ursula, and made an attempt to face 2 soldiers, who had opened up with heavy firing from the corner. The old pistols that had been kept for many years in the bureau did not work. Protecting Arcadio with her body, Ursula tried to drag him toward the house. come along in the name of God?" she shouted at him. "There's been enough madness." The soldiers aimed at them. "Let go of that man, ma'am," one of them shouted. "Oh, we won't be responsible." Arcadio pushed Ursula toward the house and surrendered. A short time later, the shooting stopped and the bells began to toll. The resistance had been wiped out in less than half an hour. Not a single one of Arcadio's men had survived the attack, but before dying they had killed 300 soldiers. The last stronghold was the barracks. Before being attacked, the supposed Colonel Gregorio Stevenson had freed the prisoners and ordered his men to go out and fight in the street. The extraordinary mobility and accurate aim with which he placed his 20 cartridges gave the impression that the barracks was well defended, and the attackers blew it to pieces with cannon fire. The captain who directed the operation was startled to find the rubble deserted, and a single dead man in his undershorts, with an empty rifle still clutched in an arm that had been blown completely off. He had a woman's full head of hair held at the neck with a comb, and on his neck a chain with a small gold fish. When he turned him over with the tip of his boot and put the light on his face, the captain was perplexed. "Jesus Christ," he exclaimed. Other officers came over. "Look where this fellow turned up," the captain said. "It's Gregorio Stevenson." At dawn, after a summary court-martial, Arcadio was shot against the wall of the cemetery. In the last 2 hours of his life, he did not manage to understand why the fear that had tormented him since childhood had disappeared. Impassive, without even worrying about making a show of his recent bravery, he listened to the interminable charges of the accusation. He thought about Ursula, who at that hour must have been under the chestnut tree having coffee with José Arcadio Buendía. He thought about his 8-month-old daughter, who still had no name, and about the child who was going to be born in August. He thought about Santa Sofia de la Piedad, whom he had left the night before, salting down a deer for the next day's lunch. And he missed her hair pouring over her shoulders and her eyelashes, which looked as if they were artificial. He thought about his people without sentimentality, with the strict closing of his accounts with life, beginning to understand how much he really loved the people he hated most. The president of the court-martial began his final speech when Arcadio realized that 2 hours had passed. "Even if the proven charges did not have merit enough," the president was saying, "the irresponsible and criminal boldness with which the accused drove his subordinates on to a useless death would be enough to deserve capital punishment." In the shattered schoolhouse, where for the first time he had felt the security of power, a few feet from the room where he had come to know the uncertainty of love, Arcadio found the formality of death ridiculous. Death really did not matter to him, but life did. And therefore the sensation he felt when they gave their decision was not a feeling of fear, but of nostalgia. He did not speak until they asked him for his last request. "Tell my wife," he answered in a well-modulated voice, "to give the girl the name of Ursula." He paused and said it again. "Ursula, like her grandmother. And tell her also that if the child that is to be born is a boy, they should name him José Arcadio, not for his uncle, but for his grandfather." Before they took him to the execution wall, Father Nicanor tried to attend him. "I have nothing to repent," Arcadio said, and he put himself under the orders of the squad after drinking a cup of black coffee. The leader of the squad, a specialist in summary executions, had a name that had much more about it than chance. Captain Roque Carnicero, which meant butcher. On the way to the cemetery, under the persistent drizzle, Arcadio saw that a radiant Wednesday was breaking out on the horizon. His nostalgia disappeared with the mist, and left an immense curiosity in its place. Only when they ordered him to put his back to the wall did Arcadio see Rebecca, with wet hair and a pink flowered dress, opening wide the door. He made an effort to get her to recognize him, and Rebecca did take a casual look toward the wall, and was paralyzed with stupor, barely able to react and wave goodbye to Arcadio. Arcadio answered her the same way. At that instant, the smoking mouths of the rifles were aimed at him, and letter by letter, he heard the encyclicals that Melquiades had chanted, and he heard the lost steps of Santa Sofia de la Piedad, a virgin, in the classroom, and in his nose he felt the same icy hardness that had drawn his attention in the nostrils of the corpse of Remedios. "Oh, God damn it," he managed to think. "I forgot to say that if it was a girl, they should name her Remedios." Then, all accumulated in the rip of a claw, he felt again all the terror that had tormented him in his life. The captain gave the order to fire. Arcadio barely had time to put out his chest and raise his head, not understanding where the hot liquid that burned his thighs was pouring from. "Bastards!" he shouted. "Long live the Liberal Party!" The war was over in May. 2 weeks before the government made the official announcement in a high-sounding proclamation, which promised merciless punishment for those who had started the rebellion, Colonel Aureliano Buendia fell prisoner, just as he was about to reach the western frontier, disguised as an Indian witch doctor. Of the 21 men who had followed him to war, 14 fell in combat, 6 were wounded, and only one accompanied him at the moment of final defeat, Colonel Gerineldo Marquez. The news of his capture was announced in Macondo with a special proclamation. "He's alive," Ursula told her husband. "Let's pray to God for his enemies to show him clemency." After 3 days of weeping, one afternoon as she was stirring some sweet milk candy in the kitchen, she heard her son's voice clearly in her ear. "It was Aureliano," she shouted, running toward the chestnut tree to tell her husband the news. "I don't know how the miracle took place, but he's alive and we're going to see him very soon." She took it for granted. She had the floors of the house scrubbed and changed the position of the furniture. 1 week later, a rumor from somewhere that was not supported by any proclamation gave dramatic confirmation to the prediction. Colonel Aureliano Buendia had been condemned to death, and the sentence would be carried out in Macondo as a lesson to the population. One Monday, at 10:30 in the morning, Amaranta was dressing Aureliano Jose when she heard the sound of a distant troop and the blast of a cornet 1 second before Ursula burst into the room with the shout, "They're bringing him now!" The troop struggled to subdue the overflowing crowd with their rifle butts. Ursula and Amaranta ran to the corner, pushing their way through, and then they saw him. He looked like a beggar. His clothing was torn, his hair and beard were tangled, and he was barefoot. He was walking without feeling the burning dust, his hands tied behind his back with a rope that a mounted officer had attached to the head of his horse. Along with him, also ragged and defeated, they were bringing Colonel Gerineldo Marquez. They were not sad. They seemed more disturbed by the crowd that was shouting all kinds of insults at the troops. "My son!" Ursula shouted in the midst of the uproar, and she slapped the soldier who tried to hold her back. The officer's horse reared. Then Colonel Aureliano Buendia stopped, tremulous, avoided the arms of his mother and fixed a stern look on her eyes. "Go home, Mama," he said. "Get permission from the authorities to come see me in jail." He looked at Amaranta, who stood indecisively 2 steps behind Ursula, and he smiled as he asked her, "What happened to your hand?" Amaranta raised the hand with the black bandage. "A burn," she said, and took Ursula away so that the horses would not run her down. The troop took off. A special guard surrounded the prisoners and took them to the jail at a trot. At dusk, Ursula visited Colonel Aureliano Buendia in jail. She had tried to get permission through Don Apolinar Moscote, but he had lost all authority in the face of the military omnipotence. Father Nicanor was in bed with hepatic fever. The parents of Colonel Gerineldo Marquez, who had not been condemned to death, had tried to see him and were driven off with rifle butts. Facing the impossibility of finding anyone to intervene, convinced that her son would be shot at dawn, Ursula wrapped up the things she wanted to bring him and went to the jail alone. "I am the mother of Colonel Aureliano Buendia," she announced. The sentries blocked her way. "I'm going in any case," Ursula warned them, "so if you have orders to shoot, start right in." She pushed one of them aside and went into the former classroom, where a group of half-dressed soldiers were oiling their weapons. An officer in a field uniform, ruddy-faced, with very thick glasses and ceremonious manners, signalled to the sentries to withdraw. "I am the mother of Colonel Aureliano Buendia," Ursula repeated. "You must mean," the officer corrected her with a friendly smile, "that you are the mother of Mr. Aureliano Buendia." Ursula recognized in his affected way of speaking the languid cadence of the stuck-up people from the Highlands.
"As you say, Mr.," she accepted, "just as long as I can see him."
There were superior orders that prohibited visits to prisoners condemned to death, but the officer assumed the responsibility of letting her have a 15-minute stay. Ursula showed him what she had in the bundle, a change of clean clothing, the short boots that her son had worn at his wedding, and the sweet milk candy that she had kept for him since the day she had sensed his return. She found Colonel Aureliano Buendia in the room that was used as a cell, lying on a cot with his arms spread out, because his armpits were paved with sores. They had allowed him to shave. The thick moustache, with twisted ends, accentuated the sharp angles of his cheekbones. He looked paler to Ursula than when he had left, a little taller and more solitary than ever. He knew all about the details of the house, Pietro Crespi's suicide, Arcadio's arbitrary acts and execution, the dauntlessness of José Arcadio Buendía underneath the chestnut tree. He knew that Amaranta had consecrated her virginal widowhood to the rearing of Aureliano José, and that the latter was beginning to show signs of quite good judgment, and that he had learned to read and write at the same time he had learned to speak. From the moment in which she entered the room, Ursula felt inhibited by the maturity of her son, by his aura of command, by the glow of authority that radiated from his skin. She was surprised that he was so well informed. "You knew all along that I was a wizard," he joked, and he added in a serious tone, "This morning, when they brought me in, I had the impression that I had already been through all that before." In fact, while the crowd was roaring alongside him, he had been concentrating his thoughts, startled at how the town had aged. The leaves of the almond trees were broken. The houses, painted blue, then painted red, had ended up with an indefinable coloration. "What did you expect?" Ursula sighed. "Time passes." "That's how it goes," Aureliano admitted, "but not so much." In that way, the long-awaited visit, for which both had prepared questions and had even anticipated answers, was once more the usual everyday conversation. When the guard announced the end of the visit, Aureliano took out a roll of sweaty papers from under the cot. They were his poetry, the poems inspired by Remedios, which he had taken with him when he left, and those he had written later on, during chance pauses in the war. "Promise me that no one will read them," he said. "Light the oven with them this very night." Ursula promised and stood up to kiss him goodbye. "I brought you a revolver," she murmured. Colonel Aureliano Buendia saw that the sentry could not see. "It won't do me any good," he said in a low voice, "but give it to me in case they search you on the way out." Ursula took the revolver out of her bodice and put it under the mattress of the cot. "And don't say goodbye," he concluded with emphatic calmness. "Don't beg or bow down to anyone. Pretend that they shot me a long time ago." Ursula bit her lip so as not to cry. "Put some hot stones on those sores," she said. She turned halfway around and left the room. Colonel Aureliano Buendia remained standing, thoughtful, until the door closed. Then he lay down again with his arms open. Since the beginning of adolescence, when he had begun to be aware of his premonitions, he thought that death would be announced with a definite, unequivocal, irrevocable signal, but there were only a few hours left before he would die, and the signal had not come. On a certain occasion, a very beautiful woman had come into his camp in Tukarenka and asked the sentries permission to see him. They let her through because they were aware of the fanaticism of some mothers who sent their daughters to the bedrooms of the most famous warriors, according to what they said, to improve the breed. That night, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was finishing the poem about the man who is lost in the rain when the girl came into his room. He turned his back to her to put the sheet of paper into the locked drawer where he kept his poetry. And then he sensed it.
He grasped the pistol in the drawer without turning his head. "Please don't shoot," he said. When he turned around, holding his pistol, the girl had lowered hers and did not know what to do. In that way he had avoided 4 out of 11 traps. On the other hand, someone who was never caught entered the revolutionary headquarters one night in Manaure and stabbed to death his close friend, Colonel Magnifico Bispal, to whom he had given his cot so that he could sweat out a fever. A few yards away, sleeping in a hammock in the same room, he was not aware of anything. His efforts to systematize his premonitions were useless. They would come suddenly in a wave of supernatural lucidity, like an absolute and momentaneous conviction, but they could not be grasped. On occasion, they were so natural that he identified them as premonitions only after they had been fulfilled. Frequently, they were nothing but ordinary bits of superstition. But when they condemned him to death and asked him to state his last wish, he did not have the least difficulty in identifying the premonition that inspired his answer. "I ask that the sentence be carried out in Macondo," he said. The president of the court-martial was annoyed. "Don't be clever, Buen dia," he told him. "That's just a trick to gain more time. If you don't fulfill it, that will be your worry," the colonel said. "But that's my last wish." Since then, the premonitions had abandoned him. The day when Ursula visited him in jail, after a great deal of thinking, he came to the conclusion that perhaps death would not be announced that time, because it did not depend on chance, but on the will of his executioners. He spent the night awake, tormented by the pain of his sores. A little before dawn, he heard steps in the hallway. "They're coming," he said to himself, and for no reason he thought of José Arcadio Buendía, who at that moment was thinking about him under the dreary dawn of the chestnut tree. He did not feel fear or nostalgia, but an intestinal rage at the idea that this artificial death would not let him see the end of so many things that he had left unfinished. The door opened, and a sentry came in with a mug of coffee. On the following day, at the same hour, he would still be doing what he was then, raging with the pain in his armpits, and the same thing happened. On Thursday he shared the sweet milk candy with the guards and put on his clean clothes, which were tight for him, and the patent leather boots. By Friday they had still not shot him. Actually, they did not dare carry out the sentence. The rebelliousness of the town made the military men think that the execution of Colonel Aureliano Buendía might have serious political consequences not only in Macondo, but throughout the area of the swamp. So they consulted the authorities in the capital of the province. On Saturday night, while they were waiting for an answer, Captain Roque Canicero went with some of the other officers to Caterino's place. Only one woman, practically threatened, dared take him to her room. "They don't want to go to bed with a man they know is going to die," she confessed to him. "No one knows how it will come, but everybody is going around saying that the officer who shoots Colonel Aureliano Buendía and all the soldiers in the squad, one by one, will be murdered with no escape, sooner or later, even if they hide at the ends of the earth." Captain Roque Carnicero mentioned it to the other officers, and they told their superiors. On Sunday, although no one had revealed it openly, although no action on the part of the military had disturbed the tense calm of those days, the whole town knew that the officers were ready to use any manner of pretext to avoid responsibility for the execution. The official order arrived in the Monday mail. The execution was to be carried out within 24 hours. That night, the officers put 7 slips of paper into a cap, and Captain Roque Carnicero's unpeaceful fate was foreseen by his name on the prize slip. "Bad luck doesn't have any chinks in it," he said with deep bitterness. "I was born a son of a bitch, and I'm going to die a son of a bitch." At 5 in the morning he chose the squad by lot, formed it in the courtyard, and woke up the condemned man with a premonitory phrase. "Let's go, Buen dia," he told him. "Our time has come." "So that's what it was," the colonel replied. "I was dreaming that my sores had burst." Rebecca Buendía got up at 3 in the morning when she learned that Aureliano would be shot. She stayed in the bedroom in the dark, watching the cemetery wall through the half-opened window, as the bed on which she sat shook with José Arcadio's snoring. She had waited all week with the same hidden persistence with which, during different times, She had waited for Pietro Crespi's letters. "They won't shoot him here," Jose Arcadio told her. "They'll shoot him at midnight in the barracks so that no one will know who made up the squad, and they'll bury him right there." Rebecca kept on waiting. "They're stupid enough to shoot him here," she said. She was so certain that she had foreseen the way she would open the door to wave goodbye. "They won't bring him through the streets," Jose Arcadio insisted, "with 6 scared soldiers and knowing that the people are ready for anything." Indifferent to her husband's logic, Rebecca stayed by the window. "You'll see that they're just stupid enough," she said. On Tuesday, at 5 in the morning, Jose Arcadio had drunk his coffee and let the dogs out, when Rebecca closed the window and held on to the head of the bed so as not to fall down.
They're bringing him," she sighed. "He's so handsome."
Jose Arcadio looked out the window and saw him, tremulous in the light of dawn. He already had his back to the wall and his hands were on his hips, because the burning knots in his armpits would not let him lower them.
"A person fucks himself up so much," Colonel Aureliano Buendia said. "Fucks himself up so much, just so that 6 weak fairies can kill him, and he can't do anything about it."
He repeated it with so much rage that it almost seemed to be fervor, and Captain Roque Carnicero was touched, because he thought he was praying. When the squad took aim, the rage had materialized into a viscous and bitter substance that put his tongue to sleep and made him close his eyes. Then the aluminum glow of dawn disappeared, and he saw himself again in short pants, wearing a tie around his neck, and he saw his father leading him into the tent on a splendid afternoon, and he saw the ice. When he heard the shout, he thought that it was the final command to the squad. He opened his eyes with a shudder of curiosity, expecting to meet the incandescent trajectory of the bullets. But he only saw Captain Roque Carnicero with his arms in the air, and Jose Arcadio crossing the street with his fearsome shotgun ready to go off.
"Don't shoot," the captain said to Jose Arcadio. "You were sent by divine providence."
Another war began right there. Captain Roque Carnicero and his 6 men left with Colonel Aureliano Buendia to free the revolutionary general Victorio Medina, who had been condemned to death in Riohacha. They thought they could save time by crossing the mountains along the trail that Jose Arcadio Buendia had followed to found Macondo, but before a week was out, they were convinced that it was an impossible undertaking. So they had to follow the dangerous route over the outcroppings, with no other munitions but what the firing squad had. They would camp near the towns, and one of them, with a small gold fish in his hand, would go in disguise in broad daylight to contact the dormant liberals, who would go out hunting on the following morning and never return. When they saw Riohacha from a ridge in the mountains, General Vittorio Medina had been shot. Colonel Aureliano Buendia's men proclaimed him chief of the revolutionary forces of the Caribbean coast with the rank of general. He assumed the position, but refused the promotion, and took the stand that he would never accept it as long as the conservative regime was in power. At the end of 3 months, they had succeeded in arming more than 1,000 men, but they were wiped out. The survivors reached the eastern frontier. The next thing that was heard of them was that they had landed on Cabo de la Vela, coming from the smaller islands of the Antilles, and a message from the government was sent all over by telegraph and included in jubilant proclamations throughout the country announcing the death of Colonel Aureliano Buendia. But 2 days later, a multiple telegram, which almost overtook the previous one, announced another uprising on the southern plains. That was how the legend of the ubiquitous Colonel Aureliano Buendia began. Simultaneous and contradictory information declared him victorious in Villanueva, defeated in Guacamayal, devoured by Motilon Indians, dead in a village in the swamp, and up in arms again in Urumita. The liberal leaders, who at that moment were negotiating for participation in the Congress, branded him an adventurer who did not represent the party. The national government placed him in the category of a bandit and put a price of 5,000 pesos on his head. After 16 defeats, Colonel Aureliano Buendia left Guajira with 2,000 well-armed Indians and the garrison, which was taken by surprise as it slept, abandoned Riohacha. He established his headquarters there and proclaimed total war against the regime.
The first message he received from the government was a threat to shoot Colonel Gerineldo Márquez within 48 hours if he did not withdraw with his forces to the eastern frontier. Colonel Roque Carnicero, who was his chief of staff then, gave him the telegram with a look of consternation, but he read it with unforeseen joy. "How wonderful!" he exclaimed. "We have a telegraph office in Macondo now." His reply was definitive. In 3 months he expected to establish his headquarters in Macondo. If he did not find Colonel Gerineldo Márquez alive at that time, he would shoot out of hand all of the officers he held prisoner at that moment, starting with the generals, and he would give orders to his subordinates to do the same for the rest of the war. 3 months later, when he entered Macondo in triumph, the first embrace he received on the swamp road was that of Colonel Gerineldo Márquez. The house was full of children. Ursula had taken in Santa Sofia de la Piedad with her older daughter and a pair of twins, who had been born 5 months after Arcadio had been shot. Contrary to the victim's last wishes, she baptized the girl with the name Remedios. "I'm sure that was what Arcadio meant," she alleged. "We won't call her Ursula, because a person suffers too much with that name." The twins were named José Arcadio II and Aureliano II. Amaranta took care of them all. She put small wooden chairs in the living room and established a nursery with other children from neighboring families. When Colonel Aureliano Buendia returned in the midst of exploding rockets and ringing bells, a children's chorus welcomed him to the house. Aureliano José, tall like his grandfather, dressed as a revolutionary officer, gave him military honors. Not all the news was good. A year after the flight of Colonel Aureliano Buendia, José Arcadio and Rebecca went to live in the house Arcadio had built. No one knew about his intervention to halt the execution. In the new house, located on the best corner of the square, in the shade of an almond tree that was honored by 3 nests of redbreasts, with a large door for visitors and 4 windows for light, they set up a hospitable home. Rebecca's old friends, among them 4 of the Moscote sisters who were still single, once more took up the sessions of embroidery that had been interrupted years before on the porch with the begonias. José Arcadio continued to profit from the usurped lands, the title to which was recognized by the conservative government. Every afternoon he could be seen returning on horseback, with his hunting dogs and his double-barreled shotgun and a string of rabbits hanging from his saddle. One September afternoon, with the threat of a storm, he returned home earlier than usual. He greeted Rebecca in the dining room, tied the dogs up in the courtyard, hung the rabbits up in the kitchen to be salted later, and went to the bedroom to change his clothes. Rebecca later declared that when her husband went into the bedroom, she was locked in the bathroom and did not hear anything. It was a difficult version to believe, but there was no other more plausible, and no one could think of any motive for Rebecca to murder the man who had made her happy. That was perhaps the only mystery that was never cleared up in Macondo. As soon as José Arcadio closed the bedroom door, the sound of a pistol shot echoed through the house. A trickle of blood came out under the door, crossed the living room, went out into the street, continued on in a straight line across the uneven terraces, went down steps and climbed over curbs, passed along the Street of the Turks, turned a corner to the right and another to the left, made a right angle at the Buendia house, went in under the closed door, crossed through the parlor, hugging the walls so as not to stain the rugs, went on to the other living room, made a wide curve to avoid the dining room table, went along the porch with the begonias, and passed without being seen under Amaranta's chair as she gave an arithmetic lesson to Aureliano José, and went through the pantry and came out in the kitchen, where Ursula was getting ready to crack 36 eggs to make bread.
"Holy Mother of God!"
Ursula shouted. She followed the thread of blood back along its course, and in search of its origin she went through the pantry, along the begonia porch, where Aureliano José was chanting that 3 plus 3 is 6, and 6 plus 3 is 9, and she crossed the dining room and the living rooms, and followed straight down the street, and she turned first to the right and then to the left, to the Street of the Turks, forgetting that she was still wearing her baking apron and her house slippers. And she came out onto the square and went into the door of a house where she had never been, and she pushed open the bedroom door
and was almost suffocated by the smell of burned gunpowder, and she found José Arcadio lying face down on the ground on top of the leggings he had just taken off, and she saw the starting point of the thread of blood that had already stopped flowing out of his right ear. They found no wound on his body, nor could they locate the weapon, nor was it possible to remove the smell of powder from the corpse. First, they washed him 3 times with soap and a scrubbing brush. Then they rubbed him with salt and vinegar, then with ashes and lemon. And finally they put him in a barrel of lye and let him stay for 6 hours. They scrubbed him so much that the arabesques of his tattooing began to fade. When they thought of the desperate measure of seasoning him with pepper, cumin seeds, and laurel leaves, and boiling him for a whole day over a slow fire, he had already begun to decompose, and they had to bury him hastily. They sealed him hermetically in a special coffin, 7.5 feet long and 4 feet wide, reinforced inside with iron plates, and fastened together with steel bolts. And even then the smell could be perceived on the streets through which the funeral procession passed. Father Nicanor, with his liver enlarged and tight as a drum, gave him his blessing from bed. Although in the months that followed they reinforced the grave with walls about it, between which they threw compressed ash, sawdust, and quicklime, the cemetery still smelled of powder for many years after, until the engineers from the banana company covered the grave over with a shell of concrete. As soon as they took the body out, Rebecca closed the doors of her house and buried herself alive, covered with a thick crust of disdain that no earthly temptation was ever able to break. She went out into the street on one occasion, when she was very old, with shoes the color of old silver, and a hat made of tiny flowers, during the time that the Wandering Jew passed through town and brought on a heat wave that was so intense that birds broke through window screens to come to die in the bedrooms. The last time anyone saw her alive was when, with one shot, she killed a thief who was trying to force the door of her house. Except for Argenida, her servant and confidant, no one ever had any more contact with her after that. At one time it was discovered that she was writing letters to the bishop, whom she claimed as a first cousin, but it was never said whether she received any reply. The town forgot about her. In spite of his triumphal return, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was not enthusiastic over the looks of things. The government troops abandoned their positions without resistance, and that aroused an illusion of victory among the liberal population that it was not right to destroy. But the revolutionaries knew the truth, Colonel Aureliano Buendia, better than any of them. Although at that moment he had more than 5,000 men under his command and held 2 coastal states, he had the feeling of being hemmed in against the sea and caught in a situation that was so confused that when he ordered the restoration of the church steeple, which had been knocked down by army cannon fire, Father Nicanor commented from his sickbed, "This is silly. The defenders of the faith of Christ destroy the church, and the masons order it rebuilt." Looking for a loophole through which he could escape, he spent hours on end in the telegraph office, conferring with the commanders of other towns, and every time he would emerge with the firmest impression that the war was at a stalemate. When news of fresh liberal victories was received, it was celebrated with jubilant proclamations, but he would measure the real extent of them on the map, and could see that his forces were penetrating into the jungle, defending themselves against malaria and mosquitoes, advancing in the opposite direction from reality. "We're wasting time," he would complain to his officers. "We're wasting time while the bastards in the party are begging for seats in Congress." Lying awake at night, stretched out on his back in a hammock in the same room where he had awaited death, he would evoke the image of lawyers dressed in black, leaving the presidential palace in the icy cold of early morning, with their coat collars turned up about their ears, rubbing their hands, whispering, taking refuge in dreary early morning cafes, to speculate over what the president had meant when he said yes, or what he had meant when he said no, and even to imagine what the president was thinking when he said something quite different, as he chased away mosquitoes at a temperature of 95 degrees, feeling the approach of the fearsome dawn when he would have to give his men the command to jump into the sea. One night of uncertainty, when Pilar Tenera was singing in the courtyard with the soldiers, he asked her to read the future in her cards. "Watch out for your mouth.
was all that Pilar Ternera brought out after spreading and picking up the cards three times.
I don't know what it means, but the sign is very clear. Watch out for your mouth.
2 days later, someone gave an orderly a mug of black coffee, and the orderly passed it on to someone else, and that one to someone else, until, hand to hand, it reached Colonel Aureliano Buendia's office. He had not asked for any coffee, but since it was there, the colonel drank it. It had a dose of Nux Vomica, strong enough to kill a horse. When they took him home, he was stiff and arched, and his tongue was sticking out between his teeth. Ursula fought against death over him. After cleaning out his stomach with emetics, she wrapped him in hot blankets and fed him egg whites for 2 days, until his harrowed body recovered its normal temperature. On the fourth day, he was out of danger. Against his will, pressured by Ursula and his officers, he stayed in bed for another week. Only then did he learn that his verses had not been burned.
"I didn't want to be hasty," Ursula explained to him. "That night when I went to light the oven, I said to myself that it would be better to wait until they brought the body."
In the haze of convalescence, surrounded by Remedios' dusty dolls, Colonel Aureliano Buendia brought back the decisive periods of his existence by reading his poetry. He started writing again. For many hours, balancing on the edge of the surprises of a war with no future, in rhymed verse, he resolved his experience on the shores of death. Then his thoughts became so clear that he was able to examine them forward and backward. One night he asked Colonel Herinaldo Marquez,
"Tell me something, old friend. Why are you fighting?"
"What other reason could there be?" Colonel Herinaldo Marquez answered.
"For the great Liberal Party."
"You're lucky, because you know why," he answered. "As far as I'm concerned, I've come to realize only just now that I'm fighting because of pride."
"That's bad,"
Colonel Herinaldo Marquez said. Colonel Aureliano Buendia was amused at his alarm.
"Naturally," he said, "but in any case, it's better than not knowing why you're fighting."
He looked him in the eyes and added with a smile, "Or fighting, like you, for something that doesn't have any meaning for anyone." His pride had prevented him from making contact with the armed groups in the interior of the country, until the leaders of the party publicly rectified their declaration that he was a bandit. He knew, however, that as soon as he put those scruples aside, he would break the vicious circle of the war. Convalescence gave him time to reflect. Then he succeeded in getting Ursula to give him the rest of her buried inheritance and her substantial savings. He named Colonel Herinaldo Marquez civil and military leader of Macondo, and he went off to make contact with the rebel groups in the interior. Colonel Herinaldo Marquez was not only the man closest to Colonel Aureliano Buendia, but Ursula received him as a member of the family. Fragile, timid, with natural good manners, he was, however, better suited for war than for government. His political advisers easily entangled him in theoretical labyrinths, but he succeeded in giving Macondo the atmosphere of rural peace that Colonel Aureliano Buendia dreamed of, so that he could die of old age making little gold fishes. Although he lived in his parents' house, he would have lunch at Ursula's 2 or 3 times a week. He initiated Aureliano José in the use of firearms, gave him early military instruction, and for several months took him to live in the barracks, with Ursula's consent, so that he could become a man. Many years before, when he was still almost a child, Herinaldo Marquez had declared his love for Amaranta. At that time she was so illusioned with her lonely passion for Pietro Crespi that she laughed at him. Herinaldo Marquez waited. On a certain occasion he sent Amaranta a note from jail, asking her to embroider 12 batiste handkerchiefs with his father's initials on them. He sent her the money. A week later, Amaranta brought the 12 handkerchiefs to him in jail, along with the money, and they spent several hours talking about the past.
"When I get out of here, I'm going to marry you," Herinaldo Marquez told her when she left.
Amaranta laughed, but she kept on thinking about him while she taught the children to read, and she tried to revive her juvenile passion for Pietro Crespi. On Saturdays, visiting days for the prisoners, she would stop by the house of Herinaldo Marquez's parents and accompany them to the jail. On one of those Saturdays, Ursula was surprised to see her in the kitchen, waiting for the biscuits to come out of the oven,
so that she could pick the best ones and wrap them in a napkin that she had embroidered for the occasion. "Marry him," she told her. "You'll have a hard time finding another man like him." Amarantha feigned a reaction of displeasure. "I don't have to go around hunting for men," she answered. "I'm taking these biscuits to Herinaldo, because I'm sorry that sooner or later they're going to shoot him." She said it without thinking, but that was the time that the government had announced its threat to shoot Colonel Herinaldo Marquez if the rebel forces did not surrender Riohacha. The visit stopped. Amarantha shut herself up to weep, overwhelmed by a feeling of guilt similar to the one that had tormented her when Remedios died, as if once more her careless words had been responsible for a death. Her mother consoled her. She assured her that Colonel Aureliano Buendia would do something to prevent the execution, and promised that she would take charge of attracting Herinaldo Marquez herself when the war was over. She fulfilled her promise before the imagined time. When Herinaldo Marquez returned to the house, invested with his new dignity of civil and military leader, she received him as a son, thought of delightful bits of flattery to hold him there, and prayed with all her soul that he would remember his plan to marry Amarantha. Her pleas seemed to be answered. On the days that he would have lunch at the house, Colonel Herinaldo Marquez would linger on the begonia porch playing Chinese checkers with Amarantha. Ursula would bring them coffee and milk and biscuits, and would take over the children so that they would not bother them. Amarantha was really making an effort to kindle in her heart the forgotten ashes of her youthful passion. With an anxiety that came to be intolerable, she waited for the lunch days, the afternoons of Chinese checkers, and time flew by in the company of the warrior, with a nostalgic name, whose fingers trembled imperceptibly as he moved the pieces. But the day on which Colonel Herinaldo Marquez repeated his wish to marry her, she rejected him. "I'm not going to marry anyone," she told him, "much less you. You love Aureliano so much that you want to marry me because you can't marry him." Colonel Herinaldo Marquez was a patient man. "I'll keep on insisting," he said. "Sooner or later I'll convince you." He kept on visiting the house. Shut up in her bedroom, biting back her secret tears, Amarantha put her fingers in her ears so as not to hear the voice of the suitor as he gave Ursula the latest war news, and in spite of the fact that she was dying to see him, she had the strength not to go out and meet him. At that time, Colonel Aureliano Buendia took the time to send a detailed account to Macondo every 2 weeks, but only once, almost 8 months after he had left, did he write to Ursula. A special messenger brought a sealed envelope to the house with a sheet of paper inside bearing the colonel's delicate hand. "Take good care of Papa, because he is going to die." Ursula became alarmed. "If Aureliano says so, it's because Aureliano knows," she said, and she had them help her take José Arcadio Buendía to his bedroom. Not only was he as heavy as ever, but during his prolonged stay under the chestnut tree, he had developed the faculty of being able to increase his weight at will, to such a degree that 7 men were unable to lift him, and they had to drag him to the bed. A smell of tender mushrooms, of woodflower fungus, of old and concentrated outdoors, impregnated the air of the bedroom as it was breathed by the colossal old man, weather-beaten by the sun and the rain. The next morning he was not in his bed. In spite of his undiminished strength, José Arcadio Buendía was in no condition to resist. It was all the same to him. If he went back to the chestnut tree, it was not because he wanted to, but because of a habit of his body. Ursula took care of him, fed him, brought him news of Aureliano. But actually, the only person with whom he was able to have contact for a long time was Prudencio Aguilar. Almost pulverized at that time by the decrepitude of death, Prudencio Aguilar would come twice a day to chat with him. They talked about fighting cocks. They promised each other to set up a breeding farm for magnificent birds, not so much to enjoy their victories, which they would not need then, as to have something to do on the tedious Sundays of death. It was Prudencio Aguilar who cleaned him, fed him, and brought him splendid news of an unknown person called Aureliano, who was a colonel in the war. When he was alone, José Arcadio Buendía consoled himself with the dream of the infinite rooms. He dreamed that he was getting out of bed, opening the door, and going into an identical room at the same bed, with a wrought iron head,
the same wicker chair, and the same small picture of the Virgin of Help on the back wall. From that room he would go into another that was just the same, the door of which would open into another that was just the same, the door of which would open into another one just the same, and then into another exactly alike, and so on to infinity. He liked to go from room to room, as in a gallery of parallel mirrors, until Prudencio Aguilar would touch him on the shoulder. Then he would go back from room to room, walking in reverse, going back over his trail, and he would find Prudencio Aguilar in the room of reality. But one night, 2 weeks after they took him to his bed, Prudencio Aguilar touched his shoulder in an intermediate room, and he stayed there forever, thinking that it was the real room. On the following morning, Ursula was bringing him his breakfast when she saw a man coming along the hall. He was short and stocky, with a black suit on and a hat that was also black, enormous, pulled down to his taciturn eyes.
"Good Lord," Ursula thought. "I could have sworn it was Melquiades."
It was Catare, Visitacion's brother, who had left the house, fleeing from the insomnia plague, and of whom there had never been any news. Visitacion asked him why he had come back, and he answered her in their solemn language, "I have come for the exequies of the king." Then they went into José Arcadio Buendía's room, shook him as hard as they could, shouted in his ear, put a mirror in front of his nostrils, but they could not awaken him. A short time later, when the carpenter was taking measurements for the coffin, through the window they saw a light rain of tiny yellow flowers falling. They fell on the town all through the night in a silent storm, and they covered the roofs, and blocked the doors, and smothered the animals who slept outdoors. So many flowers fell from the sky that in the morning the streets were carpeted with a compact cushion, and they had to clear them away with shovels and rakes, so that the funeral procession could pass by. Sitting in the wicker rocking chair with her interrupted work in her lap, Amaranta watched Aureliano José, his chin covered with foam, stropping his razor to give himself his first shave. His blackheads bled, and he cut his upper lip as he tried to shape a mustache of blonde fuzz, and when it was all over, he looked the same as before. But the laborious process gave Amaranta the feeling that she had begun to grow old at that moment.
"You look just like Aureliano when he was your age," she said. "You're a man now."
He had been for a long time, ever since that distant day when Amaranta thought he was still a child and continued getting undressed in front of him in the bathroom, as she had always done, as she had been used to doing ever since Pilar Ternera had turned him over to her to finish his upbringing. The first time that he saw her, the only thing that drew his attention was the deep depression between her breasts. He was so innocent that he asked her what had happened to her, and Amaranta pretended to dig into her breasts with the tips of her fingers and answered, "They gave me some terrible cuts." Some time later, when she had recovered from Pietro Crespi's suicide and would bathe with Aureliano José again, he no longer paid attention to the depression, but felt a strange trembling at the sight of the splendid breasts with their brown nipples. He kept on examining her, discovering the miracle of her intimacy inch by inch, and he felt his skin tingle as he contemplated the way her skin tingled when it touched the water. Ever since he was a small child, he had the custom of leaving his hammock and waking up in Amaranta's bed, because contact with her was a way of overcoming his fear of the dark. But since that day when he became aware of his own nakedness, it was not fear of the dark that drove him to crawl in under her mosquito netting, but an urge to feel Amaranta's warm breathing at dawn. Early one morning, during the time when she refused Colonel Gerineldo Márquez, Aureliano José awoke with the feeling that he could not breathe. He felt Amaranta's fingers searching across his stomach like warm and anxious little caterpillars. Pretending to sleep, he changed his position to make it easier, and then he felt the hand, without the black bandage, diving like a blind shellfish into the algae of his anxiety. Although they seemed to ignore what both of them knew, and what each one knew that the other knew, from that night on they were yoked together in an inviolable complicity. Aureliano José could not get to sleep until he heard the 12 o'clock waltz on the parlor clock, and the mature maiden, whose skin was beginning to grow sad, did not have a moment's rest until she felt slip in under her mosquito netting that sleepwalker whom she had raised.
not thinking that he would be a palliative for her solitude. Later, they not only slept together, naked, exchanging exhausting caresses, but they would also chase each other into the corners of the house and shut themselves up in the bedrooms at any hour of the day, in a permanent state of unrelieved excitement. They were almost discovered by Ursula one afternoon, when she went into the granary as they were starting to kiss.
"Do you love your aunt a lot?"
she asked Aureliano José in an innocent way. He answered that he did.
"That's good of you,"
Ursula concluded, and finished measuring the flour for the bread and returned to the kitchen. That episode drew Amaranta out of her delirium. She realized that she had gone too far, that she was no longer playing kissing games with a child, but was floundering about in an autumnal passion, one that was dangerous and had no future, and she cut it off with one stroke. Aureliano José, who was then finishing his military training, finally woke up to reality and went to sleep in the barracks. On Saturdays he would go with the soldiers to Catarino's store. He was seeking consolation for his abrupt solitude, for his premature adolescence with women who smelled of dead flowers, whom he idealized in the darkness and changed into Amaranta by means of the anxious efforts of his imagination. A short time later, contradictory news of the war began to come in. While the government itself admitted the progress of the rebellion, the officers in Macondo had confidential reports of the imminence of a negotiated peace. Toward the 1st of April, a special emissary identified himself to Colonel Gerineldo Márquez. He confirmed the fact to him that the leaders of the party had indeed established contact with the rebel leaders in the interior and were on the verge of arranging an armistice in exchange for 3 cabinet posts for the liberals, a minority representation in the Congress, and a general amnesty for rebels who laid down their arms. The emissary brought a highly confidential order from Colonel Aureliano Buendía, who was not in agreement with the terms of the armistice. Colonel Gerineldo Márquez was to choose 5 of his best men and prepare to leave the country with them. The order would be carried out with the strictest secrecy. 1 week before the agreement was announced, and in the midst of a storm of contradictory rumors, Colonel Aureliano Buendía and 10 trusted officers, among them Colonel Roque Carnicero, stealthily arrived in Macondo after midnight, dismissed the garrison, buried their weapons, and destroyed their records. By dawn they had left town, along with Colonel Gerineldo Márquez and his 5 officers. It was such a quick and secret operation that Ursula did not find out about it until the last moment, when someone tapped on her bedroom window and whispered, "If you want to see Colonel Aureliano Buendía, come to the door right now." Ursula jumped out of bed and went to the door in her nightgown, and she was just able to see the horsemen who were leaving town gallop off in a mute cloud of dust. Only on the following day did she discover that Aureliano José had gone with his father. 10 days after a joint communique by the government and the opposition announced the end of the war, there was news of the first armed uprising of Colonel Aureliano Buendía on the western border. His small and poorly armed force was scattered in less than a week, but during that year, while liberals and conservatives tried to make the country believe in reconciliation, he attempted 7 other revolts. One night he bombarded Riohacha from a schooner, and the garrison dragged out of bed and shot the 14 best-known liberals in the town as a reprisal. For more than 2 weeks, he held a customs post on the border, and from there sent the nation a call to general war. Another of his expeditions was lost for 3 months in the jungle, in a mad attempt to cross more than 1,000 miles of virgin territory, in order to proclaim war on the outskirts of the capital. On one occasion he was less than 15 miles away from Macondo, and was obliged by government patrols to hide in the mountains, very close to the enchanted region where his father had found the fossil of a Spanish galleon many years before. Visitacion died around that time. She had the pleasure of dying a natural death, after having renounced a throne out of fear of insomnia, and her last wish was that they should dig up the wages she had saved for more than 20 years under her bed, and send the money to Colonel Aureliano Buendía, so that he could go on with the war. But Ursula did not bother to dig it up, because it was rumored in those days that Colonel Aureliano Buendía had been killed in a landing near the provincial capital. The official announcement, the 4th in less than 2 years, was considered true for almost 6 months, because nothing further was heard of him. Suddenly, when Ursula and Amaranta had added new mourning to the past period, unexpected news arrived. Colonel Aureliano Buendia was alive, but apparently he had stopped harassing the government of his country and had joined with the victorious federalism of other republics of the Caribbean. He would show up under different names, father and father.